there seemed to be no concern. Now they've already done this in a shopping mall. Mike Fagg talked his father, Bill,
into the promotion and was eager to partner with Dahl. I molded this, Beck said. I felt it was a blight on the American music scene. Remember, this is almost 10 years after Woodstock, and people didn't have much to throw themselves into. Disco bashing became a cause simply because there was nothing else around. I grew up when people were marching for civil rights, marching against the war. I didn't think they would be marching because they hated the Bee Gees. Dahl had been spending the early part of summer pretending he was blowing up records on the air and was not excited about the event at Comiskey Park. It seemed to me if I drew 5,000 people, I'd be parading around in a helmet, blowing up records. It would look like an empty stadium. Even Tigers catcher Lance Parrish really didn't seem too concerned about the event's significance. When asked, he said, "I was aware of it. I just thought it'd be another promotion." Ron Heeman recalled that Bill Beck had checked himself out of the hospital that morning and showed up at the park. Heeman asked Beck, "What are you doing here?" And Bill said, "I'm worried about this promotion. It could be catastrophic." And all the best to our Chambers friend, Rowan Heeman. He's been so helpful with everything. Something was different in the air for this promotion. Bill Beck noticed a lot of people on their way to the game carrying signs with obscenities, something he'd never seen before. Tigers shortstop Alan Trammell said, "I remember from the get-go, it wasn't a normal crowd." Beck was surprised at the turnout. "I was amazed. We had anticipated 32 to 35,000. We had more security than we ever had here before. But we had as many people in here as we ever had. They kept coming and coming. Crowd was estimated 50 to 55,000. Another group estimated at 10,000 who were in the middle were being turned away at the gate, stayed outside the ballpark. Some, however, decided to take matters into their own hands. Tigers first baseman Rusty Staud recalled, "People brought ladders. They were climbing in from the outside. It was like a riot." The scene reminded White Sox fan Ron Battaglia of an earlier era. "It looked like medieval times when they go over a castle, pouring over a wall." WLUP station manager Les Elias commented, "Much to our amazement, we drew too many people." Mike Beck made the observation that this was not a typical baseball crowd. Most of these kids probably didn't know Bill Beck from Mr. Bill. This is the Woodstock they never had. Elliot Saliant was amazed when he arrived at the game. "As soon as I got out of the L stop at Comiskey Park, I was waiting nearly ankle deep in broken records. By the time I got out of the ballpark, it was already after the first game. Tickets were already sold out at this point. So I wandered outside the stadium with hundreds, if not thousands, of others who would not get into the park either." And records were being thrown frisbee style, slicing down. Cops were on horses, charging all over. I still vividly remember how imposing a man mounted on top of a 600-pound block of galloping muscle is. It was a wild scene. Chicago Sun-Times reporter Bill Gleason sensed trouble in the ballpark. "I told my wife to go to the press room and stay there." The fans there came to the game were vulgarians who became ruffians. All the signals of the imminent riot had been flashed during the first game. Hundreds of phonograph records sailed onto the playing field starting in the fifth inning. Rusty Staud recalled the records slang around. "They would slice around you and stick in the ground. It wasn't just one, it was many. Oh God almighty, I've never seen anything so dangerous in my life. I begged the guys to put on their batting helmets when they were in the field." Fireworks were tossed on the field, prompting White Sox infielder Wayne Nordhagen to comment, "These people don't realize it takes only one injury to ruin a guy's career." The Tigers' bullpen area became a battle zone. Tigers pitcher Ed Putnam left the bullpen after a cherry bomb landed so close to the back of my head that I could feel the explosion. Lance Parrish said it was very loud and crazy. People throwing albums like Frisbee, dropping M80s out of the upper deck, throwing objects onto the field. Umpire Dave Phillips recalled, The bleachers were getting full. The upper deck was filling up. And some of the fans were sailing newsreel records onto the field like frisbees. We had to stop the game several times to pick them up. I had to ask the public address announcer to make a plea for fans not to throw any more records on the field. I suppose I should have been aware of the potential problems this posed for the second game. But I was really just making sure we finished the first game. After the first game, a Tigers 4-1 victory, Dahl wearing army fatigues and a helmet rolled onto the field in a jeep, and his large legion of fans cheered as Dahl, his partner Gary Meyer, and Lorelei, who modeled for the radio station, rolled to center field to detonate the records. Dahl recalled, "We came onto the field, I did a lap around, and I was bombarded with beer and cherry bombs." Lovingly. That's how they show the love at White Sox Park. After energizing the crowd with chants of disco sucks, Dahl blew up the container. The records were in. Lance Parrish remembered just the insanity on the field when they blew up the albums in center field. Nothing like it. After he left, some of the crowd came onto the field. So the players were warming up, went back to their dugouts. At first, things seemed okay. 30-year-old fan Jim Keene recalled, "It was no riot. We were just sliding into the bases, running around, acting like the White Sox had just won the pennant. They hadn't had one in 20 years, so we figured we'll never get a real chance." Things escalated very quickly. Jack Morris recalled, "And then all hell broke loose. They charged the field and started tearing up the pitching rubber and the dirt. They took the bases. They started digging out home plate. The batting cage was dragged out and trashed. Fans unfurled banners by the foul poles. Above the field, Ron Heeman's press box, or private box, excuse me, it sheltered his wife, the wife and children of manager Don Kessinger, the White Sox manager, but fans still tried to climb into that area. It was like nothing you ever saw," said Blair Libby, a 17-year-old Dahl fan watching the scenes on the upper deck. "Bottle rockets, M80s, all sorts of stuff whizzing over your heads. Tigers outfielder Ron LaFleur said afterward, it seemed like there were kegs in every aisle of the ballpark that night, you know, because everybody was drunk." Steve Dahl, you remember, "We're looking at this thing on TV monitors, and I thought, it was great moments in World Series history. I really thought it was highlights of the 69 Mets. Then I realized it was happening now." Bill Beck asked the police and security to stay off the field and tried to no avail to calm the crowd over the public address system. Harry Carey recalled, "Bill gave up. Then he asked me to sing 'Take Me Out to the Ball Game.' The kids sang it, but they didn't leave the field." At 9:08, men from the Chicago Police Department tactical unit were called to the field to sound they weren't used to. Cheers. A huge cheer that went up from the fans who remained in the stands who wanted to see that second game. The 9th District Police Station was only a few blocks from the ballpark, and the officers came wearing riot gear. Captain Joseph Mullen had alerted the police sensing trouble. "I was driving in the 6th District at 6 o'clock and could see what was developing. The police had less than 1,000 to chase away. They swung clubs at some, caught and handcuffed others, and had the field cleared in 5 minutes. Lieutenant Robert Riley, head of the police assigned that patrol, recalled, "This is the worst night, not only in my recollection, but in the recollection of the other men who've been working here for over 25 years. It's as bad a night as when the Beatles were here." The police were kept busy. 39 persons were arrested and charged with disorderly conduct. One of those arrested was charged with aggravated assault with a knife. It could have been worse. Mike Beck said, "The great thing was all these kids were stolen. Then we had drunks to deal with. Then we would have some trouble." Between games of a doubleheader, Dave Phillips took a quick shower and had a bite to eat with the other umpires. The umpiring crew was in for a surprise. Phillips recalled, "The theater umpires and I walked out of the dressing room for the second game. As soon as we got out the door, we were met by a Chicago police officer. He was standing between our door and the White Sox dugout. He turned around and said at us, "Where do you guys think you're going?" We told him, "We're the umpires. We're just here to get the second game going." "No way. Have you seen the field? There is no way we're going to play this game on time." The police officer told the umpires to go to the other dressing room, which led to the stands. It was a total amazement to Dave Phillips and the crew. I have never seen anything like it. Center field was literally on fire. Some of the fans who had not deposited their records into the giant hopper started their own fires to burn their records. Home plate had been dug up, the bases were gone, people were lying all over the field smoking marijuana. We sat down in the stands and watched in dismay. It looked like a small Woodstock drug fest. It looked like a spaceship took off from center field. It was smoldering. White Sox pitcher Ross Baumgartner said, "It was the sickest thing I've ever seen in my life. I don't know how people could have such little regard for other people's safety." Sparky Anderson waited for the game to be forfeited. Only an act of God can cause a postponement. This was not an act of God. The home team is responsible for the action of the crowd and condition of the field. Anderson also noted that beer and baseball go together. They have for years. But I think these kids were doing something other than beer. Tigers Hall of Famer Ernie Harwell thought it was funny, but sort of tragic at the same time. It was quite a scary night, because it looked like they were trying to burn the stadium down. There were fires everywhere. Nobody was trying to put them out. Tigers TV announcer George Kell reported that the order had been restored. Fans were calm, and the field was in good shape. Maybe he was on something, I don't know. His partner Al Kaline disagreed. After attending the umpires meeting, he reported, "They're afraid of someone getting hurt, and also the fact that home plate was uprooted from the ground and has not been measured, not been properly put back in." Kaline also noted that was really complaining to the umpires and said, "What am I going to do with the tickets?" After the decision was made to cancel the game, Bill Beck charged into the umpires' room asking for a reversal. "We can play this goddamn game. Give me 15 minutes. We'll have the field ready." Bill said they would, annoying Vet and prompting him to kick a metal cabinet with his wooden leg. Phillips said it sounded like a hand grenade had gone off. It scared the hell out of him. It was an unusual first night ever for Tigers manager Sparky Anderson at Comiskey Park. With a tongue-in-cheek remark, "Now they get every team in the league to put on a bullshit like that, I might win a few games." American League President Lee McPhail supported the decision because the stadium was not ready to play. The field was unsafe. As for Tigers Lance Parrish, he said, "We are all excited not to go out there for the second game." Bill Beck recalled McPhail's decision a great miscarriage of justice and said he contested the umpire's judgment. Three of them stayed in the umpire's room during the melee. So it was the judgment of Nestor Charlotte and Dave Phillips. Bill Beck elaborated the only unplayable portion of the field was a strip of sod pulled up in front of the pitcher's mound and replaced by dirt. So it was merely an extension of the mound and perfectly safe. "I don't want my players there either. And he had played on far worse fields. There were no pieces of records or other debris on the field. I'm amazed, shocked, and chagrined." Some people were upset with Channel 44's coverage of the game, which showed the camera only signed "Disco Sucks," which some people considered obscene. Station General Manager Ed Morris remarked, "I was not happy with it, but it never crossed my mind this was an obscenity. We were caught in a crossfire between covering the news event or what the definition of obscenity is. I have a 29-year-old son who uses the expression, 'This sucks and that sucks.' I'm amazed not him not to use it, but he says something all the time. If my son thinks it's not obscene, I don't think it's obscene." Bill Beck took the blame for the event. "Disco Demolition was a disaster. And the strange part about it, it was a strange disaster because I had done insufficient investigation. It never occurred to me that anything like that could have happened. The most he had drawn anywhere before was 4,500. He drew that night in total at least 100,000 people, which I think is an inflated figure. things recorded at 80, because there were more people outside the park than there were inside. It took 6 squads to close the gates so no more people could get in, although we hadn't sold the place out. And cars were backed up on the Dan Ryan all the way to Fullerton, a nearly 8 mile backup. 10 years after the event, Dahl commented that he doesn't hate disco anymore. Now I hate sushi. When asked if he had plans to blow up sushi at the ball game, Dahl said, "I don't think we could ever get the smell out of the park." Thank you very much. The high five, I can't do pistols real now. No problem.
We've got like 5 minutes.
We got a question. Please
ask if you can touch
on. You're gonna cut me off? Do what you got there. As I love your presentation. As a fan of a team whose victory song is "Big Cool in the Gang," I'm offended that all this hate about disco. You get my respect. I hated it at the time. You know, the song goes, "Love is love, hate is hate." And all this talk about marijuana being the problem, I just got to say from a different perspective, if there was no alcohol and only marijuana, just say it.
And now we play this on the Green Bay Line, right?
Over the years before in Cleveland, they had 10-cent beer night. Did the organizers of this disco demolition night take that into account at all?
Not really. Interesting to say, umpire was also at Cleveland. That's the problem. But I don't think they really did. I think like they saw a minor mall, you know, organization, didn't see much going on, and they never thought it would get this huge. I think that, like we mentioned, the last summation was just surprised at it, that it became huge, out of control. Well, thank you.
A few years ago, I was watching an HBO special on the death of disco. They actually state, after Studio 54 and all that, they actually state, "This event killed disco."
Eric, good job. Quick anecdote and then a question. So I was quite young, but I was there.
I
vividly remember walking in with a Casey and the Sunshine Man 45. And it's funny, though, to this day, my mom and dad hate Steve Dahl. If I mention Steve Dahl's name to them, they just go crazy after all these years. Quick question, though. You mentioned that Bill Beck wasn't very happy with promotion immediately afterwards. In your research, is there any indication of how he felt about it, you know, maybe years later? Did he maybe change his tune a little bit?
The interesting thing is they did very little repairs in that field for the next game, and he still played. But he never really much commented on that after later. He died in 86, but I think his comments after rewriting that he didn't think it'd be that huge of an event surprised him.
Eric, excuse me. I thought it was great. Just wanted to let people know that this is one of the reasons that Nestor Chilock is one of the 11 umpires in the Hall of Fame today.
You can be a favorite trivia question.
I was there, and regarding calling off the game, I remember I had a distinct impression, even after the field was cleared, that the crowd was under control only in a very limited sense. And it wasn't just that the forefront went to the Tigers, but I was quite happy, as was my date.
And a lot of the fans were like yourself, wanted to see a game.
Yeah.
And you were baseball fans.
But I was not happy or comfortable with the crowd even after it was under control. I think that was a great
practice here. That gentleman basically said what I was going to say. I was at the game also. Outstanding presentation, by the way. But you knew it early. It was the only time I ever left the game early. My wife was with me. And two rows in front of me, and it was like the fourth inning. A record hit a guy in the net, blood splattered, we're out of here. So there's no exaggeration, it was live.
Thank you so much.